He's pointing down at the road, and when I look that way, I see a cruiser pulling up with its light bar slashing the night. I see two figures get out and start toiling up the hill toward me, flashlights bobbing and illuminating startling patches of green brush and bone-pale rocks. I shut the flashlight's defense mode down and keep the halogen beam fixed on the two drunks, who are now struggling up to their knees, spitting mad. They're still holding hands to their ears. One of them leans over and throws up a gush of pale beer, but the other, Carl, keeps his gaze fixed hard on me. I see the hate in it. There's no reasoning with him, and no way to feel safe. "Police are coming," I tell him. He looks over like he didn't notice, and he probably hadn't, and a flash of pure rage makes me tighten up my grip on the tire iron again. He wants to hurt me, maybe kill me. And maybe he wants to take his fury out on the kids.
"You fucking whore," he says.
I think about what a satisfying crunch the tire iron would make coming in contact with his teeth. He's 5'8" of bad breath and shitty posture, and I can't think I'm taking a light out of the world if I end him. But I suppose he has people who love him. Even I have that much. Officer Graham is the first to make it to my side. I'm glad to see him. He's bigger and taller, and he looks like he could intimidate the spine out of just about anyone if he wanted to give it a try. He takes in the situation, frowns, and says, "What the hell is going on?" It's in my best interest to get my story in first, and I'm quick off the mark. "These idiots decided to pay me a not-so-friendly visit," I say. "They blocked us into the driveway. Somebody, probably them, vandalized the house. I tried to go cross-country, but a rock took out my steering. I didn't have a choice. I had to try to keep them away from my kids."
"Lying bitch."
Graham extends a hand toward the drunk without taking his gaze off me.
"Officer Claremont will be taking your statement," he tells him.
"Kiz?" Graham's partner tonight is a tall, lean African-American woman with close-cropped hair and a no-nonsense briskness. She leads the two drunks over to the wrecked pickup and calls for rescue and an ambulance to get the three from the cab and the one broken farther up the hill. They're babbling at her in high-pitched, urgent, slurring voices. I don't imagine she's enjoying herself.
"So all this came with no provocation at all, is what you're saying," Graham says.
I turn back to look at him, then lean to Connor's open window to kiss his forehead. "Lanny, you all right, sweetheart?" She gives me a thumbs up and tilts her head back to help slow down the bloody nose.
"Mind putting down the tire iron?"
Graham says in a dry voice, and I realize I'm clutching it tightly, as if I'm still facing threats. My thumb is resting on the stun function button of the flashlight, too. I ease myself back from that invisible cliff and lay both things down next to the Jeep, then take a couple of steps away.
"Okay, good start. Now you said these boys blocked you in? You had words with them?"
"I don't even know them," I say. "But I guess the information is out about my ex. I'm assuming you know." He doesn't betray much, but I see something stir down in the depths of his gaze, and his mouth goes tight. He deliberately loosens it.
"As I understand it, your husband is a convicted murderer."
"Ex-husband."
"Uh-huh.
A serial killer, if I got it right." "You know you do," I say. Words traveling fast. Guess it would in a small town like this. I asked Detective Prester for some kind of protective detail for my kids.
"We were on the way to take that up," he tells me. "We'd have been parked out front tonight."
I guess the paint would have probably dried by then.
"Paint?"
"Feel free to go look once you're done here. Can't miss it," I tell him. I'm flat exhausted. The aches from the crash are starting to make themselves felt. I have tenderness in my left shoulder, where I probably wrenched it against the restraints. My neck's stiff, and now my nose has a dull ache around the bridge. My nosebleed has stopped, at least, so I must not have broken anything, and when I touch it, I don't feel anything shifting. I'm fine, I think. Better than I deserve to be. This is just round one. That's why I said we needed protection.
"Miss Proctor, maybe you should consider that of the six guys who came after you. At least four of them have some kind of injuries,"
Graham says, not unkindly.
I think we can call this round for you, if you're keeping score.
I'm not, I say. But it's a lie. I'm glad that shitty pickup is lying on its side leaking radiator fluid into the ground. I'm glad four of them get a chance to nurse wounds while thinking about never coming back at me. I'm just sorry they aren't hurt badly enough to keep them from ever doing it again. You're not arresting me.
You didn't even make that a question.
Any decent defense attorney would make dog food out of you. A mother with her kids attacked by six drunk jerks. Really? I'll be the trending hero on Twitter in half an hour.
He sighs. It's a long, slow sound that mingles with the lapping of the lake's waves below.
Mist is beginning to rise from the water as air cools just enough to start the cycle, like a thousand wisps of ghosts escaping. Lake of the Dead, I think, and try not to look at it. Stillhouse Lake's beauty is ruined for me.
No, Graham finally says. I'm not arresting you. I'm arresting them for criminal mischief and good old Bobby over there for driving under the influence. Good enough?
It isn't. I want them all arrested for assault, and that word hasn't even crossed his lips. He must have seen the argument coming up in me because he holds up a hand to forestall it.
Look, they didn't lay a hand on you. At least one of 'em is sober enough to figure out he can claim they saw you wreck and came down here to help, and you got paranoid and fired off that whatever the hell it is at them. Unless we find paint or evidence of it on them or in the truck, they can claim they have no idea your house got tagged.
Tagged? It's not Banksy art.
All right, then, vandalized. But the point is, they've got good deniability for everything to do with any stalking or assault. And you're the one who had the tire iron. Far as I can tell, these men were unarmed.
Six on one don't need weapons, and he knows that. But he's right, of course. Defense attorneys cut both ways. I lean against the broken wreck of my Jeep, out of strength.
We'll need a wrecker, I tell him. My Jeep's not going anywhere without one.
I'll arrange for it, he says. Meanwhile, let's get your kids and go back to your house. Make sure nobody's gotten inside.
I know they hadn't. I have mobile notification for my alarm system, and if it goes off, I can immediately look at the tablet and rerun the footage to see who's been in there. Nobody broke any windows or kicked in any doors, but even so, the last place I want to take my kids right now is back to the house, with that red paint still dripping. I suppose they picked the garage for that particular splash pattern on purpose, reminding me where Melvin liked to do his gruesome work. But there really isn't a choice. I know just from Graham's expression that he's not taking us to any Norton motel for the night, and I strongly suspect that any calls to Detective Prester will go unanswered. With the Jeep destroyed, my only option would be to rely on the kindness of strangers, and I'm far too paranoid to even consider it. My nearest neighbors, the Johansons, helped block my driveway. Sam Cade lied to me from the beginning. Javier's a reserve deputy and probably won't return my calls either. I reach into the open Jeep window and hit the unlock button, retrieve my keys, and help Lanny out. Her nose has mostly stopped bleeding now, and it doesn't seem broken, but she might have bruises. We all might. My fault. I hold on to her as the three of us slowly follow Officer Graham up the hill, to a house that no longer feels like home.
10.
Officer Graham takes diligent pictures of the damage. The red isn't blood, it's still vividly red, and blood would have oxidized to brown by now. Paint. Most of the words are spray-painted, the exception being killer, which has extra gothic drip from the vandal's liberal dip of the paintbrush. I unlock the door and disarm the alarm, and Graham checks the whole place thoroughly. He finds nothing, but then again, I knew he wouldn't.
All right, he says, settling his sidearm in its holster as he comes back to us in the living room. I'm going to need your guns, Miss Proctor.
You have a warrant for them? I ask. He stares back at me. That's a no, then. I decline to cooperate. Get a warrant. His expression hasn't changed, but his body language has. It's shifted a little forward, become a touch more aggressive. I sense it more than see it. I remember what Connor said on the drive back. Graham's boys were the ones who beat up my son. I wonder exactly what they learned from their father. I want to trust the man. He's wearing a badge. He's the only thing truly standing between me and the angry people coming at me right now. But looking at him, I'm not sure I can make the leap. Maybe I can't trust anyone anymore. My judgment's been so off.
Okay, Graham says, though clearly he doesn't think it is. Keep the doors locked, alarm on. Does it ring at the station?
Why, so you can ignore it?
It rings directly, there, I tell him.
If the power gets cut, it also goes off.
And what about the panic room?
I say nothing to that. Just look at him.
He shrugs. Want to make sure you've got a way to get help if you're inside there. Can't help if we don't know you're in there.
It has a separate phone line, I tell him. We'll be just fine. He can tell I've gone as far down this road as I'm going, and Graham finally nods and heads for the door. I open it and see him off, and try not to look at the damage to our front door. Once it's shut, I can pretend, a little, that everything's normal. I enter the alarm code, and the soft beep of the stay signal soothes something inside me I didn't know was trembling. I put all the locks on and turn to put my back to the door. Lanny is sitting on the couch with her knees up, her arms circling them. Defensive again. Connor leans against her. There are smears of blood on my daughter's chin, and I go into the kitchen, wet a hand towel, and come back to gently clean her off. Once I have, she takes the cloth and silently does the same for me. I haven't even realized that I have so much on me. The white hand towel comes away with vivid red smears. Connor's the only one who doesn't need the cleanup, so I put the towel aside and sit with my kids, holding them and rocking with them slowly. None of us has anything to say. None of us needs to. Finally, I pick up the soiled towel and rinse it in cold water in the sink, and Lanny comes in to grab the orange juice carton and swig it down thirstily. Connor takes it when she's done. I don't even have the energy to tell them to use glasses. I just shake my head and have water. Lots of it. Do you want anything to eat? I ask them.
Both kids murmur no.
Okay, go and get some sleep. If you need me, I'll be in the shower, and I'm going to sleep out here tonight in the living room, okay?
They're not surprised. I think they must remember how, after my acquittal and before we left Kansas, I slept every night on the old sofa in the bare living room of the rented house, with a gun right at my side. We had bricks smashed through the windows, and once a flaming bottle that gutted out without starting a fire. Vandalism was a constant fact of life before we'd moved for the second time. And I'd known then, like now, that I couldn't rely on the neighbors for help, or the police. The shower feels like heaven, like a sweet, normal, warm respite from the hell of the day. I towel dry my hair and put on a fresh sports bra and underwear. Then I find the softest pair of sweatpants I have, plus a microfiber shirt and socks. I want to be as fully dressed as possible, except for my running shoes, which I've rigged up with elastic ties so I can slip them on in an emergency. The couch is comfortable enough, and I keep my gun tucked just where I can reach it, pointed away from me. Too many paranoid people have failed to practice trigger safety. To my surprise, I fall asleep, and I don't even dream. Maybe I'm too tired. I wake up to the soft beep of the automatic coffee maker as it brews the morning pot, and I make a groggy mental note to tell Lanny that if I get arrested again, to turn the damn thing off. It's still dark outside. I find my shoulder holster and put it on over my shirt, tuck the gun inside, and go to pour my coffee. I'm in my stocking feet and very quiet, but even so, I hear the creak of a door opening down the hall. It's Lanny. I know at a glance she didn't sleep much, because she's already dressed in black cargo pants and a half-ripped gray t-shirt with a skull on it and a black tank showing through the gaps. 2 years from now, I think, I'll have to fight with her to keep the tank top on under it. She's brushed out her hair but not straightened it, and the faint natural wave in it catches the light as she moves.
The reddened bruising under her eyes has turned a rich crimson, verging on brown, and her nose is a little swollen, but not as much as I'd feared. Even with the damage, she's beautiful. So beautiful, and I catch my breath on an unexpected pain and have to busy myself stirring sugar into my coffee so I don't show her the emotion. I don't even know why I'm feeling it. It comes as an overwhelming, warm wave that makes me want to destroy the world before it can hurt her again. "Move," Lanny says, annoyed, and I edge out of the way as she yanks a cup from the shelf. She checks it, an automatic thing for her from the time she was 12 and found a cockroach in a cup in a rental house, and then splashes coffee in it. She drinks hers black, not because she likes it, but because she thinks she should. "So, we're still alive."
"Still alive," I agree.
"You check the sicko patrol?"
I dread doing it, but she's right. That's the next step. "I will, in a bit." She lets out a bitter laugh.
"I guess I won't be going to school."
She isn't dressed for it, I think, and of course, she's right.
"No school. Maybe it's time for homeschool."
"Oh, yeah, that's great. We'll never get to leave the house ever again. Federal background checks on the UPS guy before we let him deliver a package."
She's in a foul mood, spoiling for a fight, and I raise my eyebrows.
"Please don't," I tell her, which makes her glare. "I'm going to need your help, Lanny."
That merits an eye roll on top of the glare, which is a neat trick I suspect only a teen girl can truly master.
"Let me guess. You want me to take care of Connor, as per warden? Maybe you should give me a badge and, you know..."
She gestures at my shoulder holster, vaguely but significantly.
"No," I tell her.
"I want you to come with me and help me go through the emails. Get your laptop. I'll show you what to do. And when we're done with that, we'll talk about next steps."
She's momentarily at a loss for words, which is a new thing. And then she puts her cup down, swallows, and says, "About time."
"Yes," I agree. "It is. But believe me, I wish I could keep it away from you forever." It's a tough morning's work, slowly acclimating her to the levels of depravity she'll encounter, and showing her how to sort and categorize them. I pre-qualify what I send her. No rape, porn, or photoshops of our faces onto murder victims. I can't do that to her. She might see it soon enough, but only because I can't help it, not because I allow it. There's a tsunami of hatred this morning, and even with two of us culling through it and reporting it back to the various abuse agencies, it takes a long, long time. Most of it's fairly regular stuff. Death threats. One finally makes her stop and roll her chair away from her laptop, hands coming away as if she's touched something dead. She looks at me wordlessly, and I see something flame out inside her. A little bit of hope. A little bit of faith that the world could still be kind, even to us.
"They're just words," I tell her,
"from small men who are brave on the other side of a keyboard and an internet handle. But I know how you feel."
"It's awful," she says in a voice that sounds more like a little girl than the adult she's trying to be.
She clears her throat and tries again.
"These people are vile."
"Yes," I say in agreement, putting my hand on her shoulder. "They'll never care whether or not you were hurt by what they said, or even if you read it. It was all about writing it for them. It's natural to feel afraid and violated by all this. I feel that way all the time."
"But?"
My daughter knows there's a but.
"But you have the power," I tell her.
"You can turn off this computer and walk away anytime. They're pixels on a screen. They're assholes who might be halfway around the world or on the other side of the country. And even if they're not, the odds are astronomically on your side that they'll never do anything that doesn't involve shouting at a computer screen. Okay?" That seems to steady her.
"Okay," she says. "And if they beat the odds?"
"Then that's why you have me, and I have this." I touch the shoulder holster. "I don't like guns. I'm not a crusader. I wish guns were harder to get, and I could rely on a cattle prod and a baseball bat. but that's not the world we live in, baby. So if you want to start learning to shoot, we'll do that. And if you don't, that's good, too. I'd rather you didn't, believe me, because your chances of getting shot are a hell of a lot better if you're armed. I do this as much to draw fire away from you as I do to return it. Understand? She does. I can see that. For the first time, she sees the weapon I'm carrying as much as a danger, as a shield. Good. It's the hardest lesson for someone who's been taught guns are the answer, that they're the only answer to a pure, simple, direct set of problems, killing someone. I never want her to have to do it. I don't want to have to do it. I get her laptop back online, and we're both silently working when Connor appears in the doorway, yawning, still in his pajama pants. He has a wide, blackening bruise on his shoulder, but other than that, he seems fine. He blinks at us and tries to finger-comb his hair straighter. "You're both up," he says. "Why isn't there breakfast?" "Shut up," Lanny says, but it's a reflex. "Such a boy. Learn to make pancakes. Not like it's rocket science." He yawns and gives me a mournful look. "Mom!" I see he wants to be treated today like a child, to be coddled and pampered and made to feel safe. It's the opposite of Lanny, who wants to face things head-on. And that's fine, too. He's younger, and it's his choice. And hers, too. I take a break from the torrential acid bath of hate and go whip up pancakes from a mix, add fresh pecans that I need to use up anyway, and we're in the middle of what feels like a startlingly normal breakfast when there's a decisive sort of knock on our disfigured front door. I get up. Lanny has already put her fork down and half-risen out of her chair, but I motion her down. Connor stops chewing and stares at me, and my mind is racing with the possibilities. Today, of all days, we face a whole new set of risks. It could be the mailman. It could be a guy with a shotgun ready to blow my face off the second he sees it. It could be someone's left me a mutilated pet on the doorstep. There's no way to tell without looking, and I get my tablet and try to boot it up. Then remember that it's dead. Batteries drained. Damn technology. It's okay, I tell them, though there's no way I can possibly know that. I go to the door and check the peephole carefully and see a tired-looking African-American woman standing there. She looks familiar, but I have trouble placing her for a few seconds because the last time I saw her, it was a fleeting glimpse and she was wearing a police uniform. It's the cop who was with Graham last night, who handled the drunks while he talked to us. I disarm and unlock, and she freezes a second as her eyes fix on the shoulder holster. "Yes?" I ask, neither inviting nor rejecting. Her dark brown eyes move up to fix on mine, and she very carefully shows me she has nothing in her hands. "My name's Claremont," she says. "Officer Claremont, I remember you from last night." "Yeah," she says. "My father lives on the other side of the lake. He says he met you and your daughter when you were out on a run." The old man, Ezekiel Claremont. "Easy." I hesitate, then extend my hand, and we shake. She has a firm, dry, businesslike grip. Up close, in casual clothes, she has an elegant style to her, something not only in the drape of her clothes, but in the cut of her hair, her perfectly shaped fingernails. Not what I would have expected from the Norton PD. "Can I come in?" she asks. "I want to help." Just like that. She keeps her gaze steady, and there's something quiet and strong about the way she says it. But I step outside and close the door behind me. "Sorry," I tell her, "but I don't know you, and I don't even know your first name." If she's taken aback by my lack of warmth and courtesy, she doesn't show it. She narrows her eyes just a bit, just for a second, and then smiles over it to say, "Kezia, Kez, for short." "Nice to meet you," I tell her, which is empty politeness. I'm wondering why the hell she's really here. "My father wanted me to come check on you," she says. "He heard about the trouble you were in. Not much a fan of the Norton PD, my pa. Must make things awkward over Sunday dinners." "You have no idea." I gestured to the porch chairs, and she settles into the one that I realize, with a sharp, glancing sort of pain, Sam Cade has always taken. It hits me with an unwelcome weight that I miss the son of a bitch. No, I don't. I miss someone who never existed in the first place, the same way my Mel never existed. The real Sam Cade is a stalker and a liar, at the very least.
Pretty over on this side, she says, scanning the view to the lake.
I'm sure she's also thinking, just as everyone else has, of how good a view I would have had of a body being dumped right out there.
His side's a little more blocked by the trees. Cheaper, though. I keep trying to get him to move down the hill so he doesn't have to climb that trail, but...
I'd love to make small talk, but my pancakes are getting cold, I tell her. What is it you want to know? She shakes her head just a little, gaze still fixed on the lake.
You know, you don't make it easy to help you out. In the position you're in, you might want to put a rein on that attitude. You're gonna need some friends.
This attitude keeps me alive. Thanks for stopping by. I start to get up again. She puts out a perfectly manicured hand to stop me and finally turns her gaze to lock on mine.
I think we might be able to help you find out who's doing this to you, she says, because we both know it's somebody close, somebody local, and somebody who's got a reason.
Sam Cade has a reason.
I helped confirm his alibi both times the girls went missing, she says. He is absolutely not the guy. They've already let him go.
Let him go? I look at the paint slopped on my garage, the words sprayed on the brick in a red fury of anger.
Great. I guess that explains this.
I don't think. Look, Kez, thanks for trying. But you're not helping me at all if your point is to convince me Sam Cade isn't a bad guy. He stalked me.
He did, she says. He's admitted to that. Said he was angry and wanted revenge. But you weren't what he thought. If he'd meant you harm, he had plenty of opportunities to do something, wouldn't you say? I think this is somebody else altogether, and I've been working on a lead. Now, do you want to know what I think, or not?
It's so tempting to say no, shove out of the chair and stalk away, but I can't make myself do it. Kezia Claremont may have ulterior motives, but her offer seems pretty sincere, and I do need a friend. Even if it's someone I can't trust any farther than I can jump, no more than I can trust Sam.
I'm listening, I finally say.
Okay. So, Stillhouse Lake's always been a pretty closed-in community up here, she says. Mostly white, mostly well-off, if not wealthy.
Not since the downturn when all these houses went into foreclosure.
True. About a third of the properties ended up getting sold or rented out in a rush last year. If we eliminate the residents who are original to the lake, that leaves about 30 houses to look at. We take yours away, that's 29. I hope you don't mind if I take my father out, 28.
I'm not willing to grant much, but I'm willing, for argument's sake, to eliminate Easy Claremont. He hadn't looked up to scaling the hill to his house, much less abducting, killing, and disposing of two healthy, strong young women. I can exempt myself, 28 houses. That includes Sam Cade, whom the police already eliminated, and I suppose, grudgingly, I might have to as well.
27, then. That's a small number.
Do you have names? I ask her.
She nods, and from her pocket she produces a folded piece of paper that she hands over. It's plain copy paper, standard from any office printer, and on it is a list of the names and addresses and phone numbers. She's been thorough. Some have asterisks, and I see that those notate criminal records. I'm not particularly suspicious of the two guys with the conviction for cooking meth who share a cabin way up the slope, but it's certainly good information to know. There's a sex offender, too, but Kezia's bold, handwritten notation shows he's already been thoroughly questioned and, though not eliminated, mostly discounted as a suspect. Kezia says,
I would have done more on my own, but I figured you might need something to do to take your mind off things.
This is all my own time, nothing on the books.
I look at her. She's not smiling.
There's something unyielding in her, something that bends but doesn't break, and I recognize it. I feel it in myself, too.
You know who I am, I say. Why do you want to help me?
Because you need it,
and easy asked. But also, she shakes her head and looks away, I know what it's like to be judged for something you never got to control. I swallow hard, taste the fleeting ghost of my cooling pancakes and syrup. I'm thirsty for coffee. You want to come inside? I ask her. We're having pancakes. I've got enough to stretch to another plate. She gives me a slow, quiet smile. I wouldn't mind. 11. Kezia Claremont, it turns out, is a hit with my kids, who start off quiet and wary. But she has a way with them, a natural charm that teases out conversations from silence. She, I think, will make a great investigator someday. She's wasted in uniform, handling rowdy drunks, though she was flawless at that, too. I warm up my breakfast as I make hers, and we eat together as the kids clean their plates and wander off to their separate areas. I think Lanny wants to stay, but I give her the quiet shake of the head and she retreats. I have some contacts, Kezia tells me quietly, once we're alone. I can start them on background work, off books. Listen, my father said you were in trouble, and no shit, those vandals hit you fast. You're gonna need some on-site protection. I know, I tell her. I'm armed, but... But offense isn't defense. Listen, you know Javier. He's the other reason I'm here. He likes you. Not willing to believe you're all the way innocent just yet, but he's willing to help keep the wolves off you if you'll agree. I think about how things might have been different if only I'd loaded up the van and departed that first time I had the impulse, headed hell-bound and out of town instead of lingering like some fool who couldn't see it coming. I had good reasons, but those reasons seem useless now. They seem like illusions. I can't trade for that van now that I've wrecked the Jeep. And anyway, Javier would never give it to me. Neither of us will want paper trails. If he's willing to keep an eye out for us, I'm good, I say. I'd feel better if I had the rest of his regiment along with him. Kez raises a sharply arched eyebrow. You better take what you get. Allies are gonna be thin on the ground for you right now. She's right, and I shut up and nod. I'll take half the list, I say. I have someone who might be willing to help do the research. Absalom won't be free. But trying to avoid paying for help would be cutting my own throat right now. I can't run. I might as well put my money to use cutting myself out of this net that Mel, because it has to be Mel, has thrown around me. Can't start a new life with it if I'm behind bars. Can't save my family if my kids are taken from me and sent to foster care. Kezia is right. At this moment, I need to take every ally I can get. So when we finish breakfast, I thank her and get her phone number in return. I realize that if I've read her wrong, everything we've discussed could be recorded, documented, part of the official Norton police record. But I don't think Prester would go that route. I text Absalom, who replies with a simple, "What?" as if I've caught him in the middle of something important, and I tell him in simple terms what I need. His reply is blunt and to the point. Thought you in jail. I text back, not guilty, and get silence for a full minute before he types one single question mark, which I know means, what do you need, in his particular, peculiar shorthand. So I take a picture of the piece of paper with Kezia's neat, precise handwriting, and tell him which names I want him to research. He texts back a price in Bitcoin that makes me wince, but he knows I'll pay it, and I do, from my computer. I don't check email. It's time to destroy the account again, even if there are clues in there. I can't swim in the toxic flood without corrupting my soul along with it. I leave it for now, transfer the money to him, and send an email with the same picture of the list, names marked, to the private investigator I've used before, along with her standard fee. I'm in the bathroom peeing when my burner phone rings, and I grab it and look at the number. I don't recognize it, but it could be Absalom. I quickly wipe and flush before I hit the answer button and say, "Hello?" "Hello, Gina." The voice takes my breath away. It's the voice from my head, the voice I can never exercise, no matter how much I pray. My fingers go numb and I lean against the sink, staring at my horrified, stark face in the mirror. Melvin Royal is on the phone with me. How is this happening?
Gina, still there?
I want to hang up. Keeping an open connection is like holding a bag full of spiders, but somehow I manage to say,
Yes, I'm here.
Melvin likes to brag, likes to savor his victories. If he's orchestrated this, he'll say so, and maybe, just maybe, he'll say something that I can use.
He has my number. How did he get my number? How could he?
Kez. She was new in my life, but I hadn't given her my number.
Sam.
No, not Sam. Please, not Sam. Wait. I'd taken my phone to the prison. I'd had to surrender it on the way in, pick it up on the way out. Someone inside there is responsible for passing along his mail. Not impossible they hacked my phone, too. They'd have had enough time. I'm ill that I didn't think of it before.
Mel's still talking. His voice holds that artificial warmth now.
Sweetheart, you're having a real bad week. Is it true there's another body?
Yes, I saw her.
What color was she?
I'd expected a lot of responses from him. Not that one.
Sorry,
I say blankly.
I made a color chart once of how they look at different stages without skin. Was she more of raw chicken color, or was it more of a slimy brown?
Shut up.
Make me, Gina. Hang up on me. But wait, if you do, you'll never find out who's coming for you.
I'm going to kill you.
Absolutely, you should do that. But you won't have time. I promise you that.
I'm colder than I think I've ever been. His voice still sounds so like him. Reasonable, calm, measured, rational. Except nothing he's saying is rational at all.
Then tell me. You're wasting time.
I guess you found out about your new friend, Sam. You just can't catch a break with men, can you? I'll bet he was thinking about all the things he was going to do to you. Got him off every night, that anticipation.
Is that what gets you off, Mel? Because it's all you'll ever get. You're never seeing me again, never touching me, and I'm going to get through this.
You don't even know what's happening. You can't see it.
Then tell me, I say. Tell me what I'm missing. I know you're dying to tell me how stupid I am.
I will, he says, and suddenly his tone shifts. The mask shreds loose, and I hear the monster talking. It's very, very different. It doesn't even sound human. I want you to know that when it comes, when it all falls down, it's your fault, you worthless, stupid bitch. I should have started with you, but I'll finish with you one of these days. You think I won't touch you? I will, from the inside out.
It raises my skin into goosebumps, makes me back into a corner, as if somehow he can reach out and grab me even through the phone.
He isn't here. He won't be here. But that voice.
You're never leaving that cell, I manage to say. I know I no longer sound like Gwen. I sound like Gina now. I am Gina now.
Oh, didn't you hear? My new lawyer thinks I have a rights violation case. Might get some evidence thrown out. Might be a new trial, Gina. What do you think? You want to go through it all again? Do you want to testify this time?
The idea makes me physically sick, and I feel acid scorch the back of my throat in a bitter wave. I don't answer him. Hang up. I'm screaming it at myself, as if I'm standing outside of my body. Hang up, hang up, hang up! It's like being trapped in a nightmare, and I can't seem to move. And then I take a breath, and the paralysis breaks, and I move my thumb to the disconnect button.
I've changed my mind, he says, but I'm already pressing. I'll tell you.
Click. I did it. He's gone. It feels like I won a point. Did I? Or did I just run away? Oh, God, if they got into my phone, they might have more from it. The kids' numbers, Absalom's. What else did I have in there? I sink down to a crouch with my back wedged in the corner between the sink and the hinges of the door, and I put the phone carefully on the floor and stare at it, as if it might change into rotting meat or burst into a flood of scorpions. I reach up and take down the hand towel, and I bite into it hard, so hard my jaw muscles ache, and I scream into the muffling comfort of it. I do that until my mind is clear again. It takes a couple of minutes. Finally, I start to close in on the questions. How? Someone at the prison must have ganked my number from the phone while I was there. But how did he call? Melvin's phone privileges are strictly reserved for his lawyer. He's not allowed contact with anyone else, and I am specifically on his do not call list. But even on death row, I imagine it's possible to buy time with a smuggled cell phone. I hope it cost him plenty, the bastard. I can't stay in the house. I feel suffocated, desperate, angry. I pace the living room for a while, and then I call Kezia Claremont at the number she's left to ask her to please, for the love of God, keep an eye on my kids. "Look out your window," she says. I do, pulling the living room curtain aside, and I see her car is still sitting in the driveway. She waves. "What's up?" I tell her about Mel's call, and she gets cool, all business, noting down the number as I read it off. He didn't bother to block it, and saying she'll check into it. I have no doubt it'll be a dead end. Even if they find the phone, it doesn't matter. He's proven he can reach out from behind those bars whenever he wants. The next time it won't be him. It'll be someone else doing his bidding. Kezia, I'm vibrating with tension, sick with it. Can you stay here and watch the house for about an hour?
Sure, she says. It's my free time. Nice day and all. Why? He give you some specific threat?
No, but I need to go just for a little while. I feel trapped in here. I'm on the verge of a meltdown, and I know it. I need to get some space, enforce some control. Hour at the most. I need to flush the confrontation with Mel out of my system before it turns toxic.
No problem, she tells me. I'm making phone calls anyway. I'll be right here.
I tell the kids I'll be back and that Kezia is right outside, and I make them swear they won't open the door while I'm gone. We go over emergency procedures. The kids are quiet and watchful. They know something's wrong with me, and it scares them. I can see that. It'll be okay, I tell them. I kiss Lanny on the head, then Connor. And they both let me without wiggling out of the embrace. That's how I know they're worried. I grab a plastic locking gun case and put my weapons in it, clip removed and chamber cleared. I leave the shoulder holster on, but empty. I put a zip-up hoodie on to cover it and stash the case in a small backpack.
Mom?
It's Lanny. I pause with my hand on the alarm pad, ready to deactivate.
I love you.
She says it quietly, but it hits me like a tsunami, and I'm knocked down inside, drowned in a storm of emotion so violent I can't even breathe. My fingers tremble on the buttons of the keypad, and for a second I'm blinded with tears. I blink them away, turn, and manage to smile at her.
I love you too, honey.
Come back soon, she says. I watch as she goes to the knife block and takes one. She turns and goes back to her room. I want to scream. I know I can't do it here. I punch in the code, get it wrong, try again, and deactivate. The door's almost open before it's safe, but I've timed it right, just barely, and I reset the alarm as I exit, then lock the door. There. My kids are secure, protected. Kezia is on the phone as I pass, and she nods to me as she makes notes in a spiral book. I kick it into a run. Not a jog. A flat-out sprint down the drive, every step just on the edge of balance, the edge of control. One wrong move will send me sprawling, probably break a bone, but I don't care. I don't care. I need to drive the poison of Melvin Royal out of my system. I run like I'm on fire. I hit the road and keep running clockwise up the incline. With the hood up, I'm just another anonymous runner at the lake. I pass a few other people, some walking, some at the docks, and I get a few glances for my speed, but nothing else. I pass Sam Cade's cabin on the right, but I don't pause. I pour more energy into my muscles, grinding off the tension, and make it all the way to the top of the ridge, where the range parking lot provides a welcome, flat, easy surface. I slow down and walk to let my muscles slow their burn. I walk in circles. My hoodie is soaked with sweat, heavy with it, and I still feel the rage screaming inside me. I'm not letting Mel win. Not ever. I pull my hood down before I open the range door, simple courtesy as well as caution, and nearly run into Javier, who's standing in the way, back to the door as he pins something up on the bulletin board. This is the store area, where they sell ammunition, hunting gear, bow hunting supplies, even camouflage-colored popcorn. The young woman manning the counter is named Sophie, and she's a seventh-generation Norton native. I know, because she's told me at length the day I signed up here. Talkative and friendly. She takes one look at me, and her face closes up shop. No small talk here, not anymore. She has the tense, glassy look of someone willing to grab an under-the-counter weapon and blast away at a second's notice. I say, "Mr. Esperanza?" And Javier finishes putting the last thumbtack into a poster and turns to look at me. He's not surprised. I'm sure, with his excellent spatial awareness, he knew exactly who I was the second I opened the door. "Miss Proctor?" He doesn't look unfriendly, like Sophie. Just politely blank. "Better not be anything in that holster. You know the rules." I unzip the hoodie to show him that it's empty, and sling the backpack off to show him the gun case. I can see him hesitate. He could refuse to allow me on the premises. It's his right, as range instructor, to do that for any reason, any time. But he just nods and says, "Bay 8 at the end is open. You know the drill." I do. I grab hearing protection from the rack and move quickly past the turned backs of other shooters, all the way to the end. Perhaps not so coincidentally, Bay 8's overhead light seems darker than the rest. I usually shoot in the bays closer toward the door. This, I remember, is the spot Carl Goetz was using that day Javi busted him for improper range procedure. Maybe it's where he puts the pariahs. I lay out my gun and clips and put on the heavy earmuffs. The relief from the steady, percussive explosions is visceral, and I finish loading with smooth, calm motions. This, for me, has become like meditation, a space to let emotions trickle away until nothing exists but me, the gun, and the target. And Mel, who stands like a ghost in front of the target. When I'm shooting, I know exactly who I'm killing. I destroy 6 targets before I feel clean and empty again, and then I lower the gun, clear the clip and chamber, and put the weapon down, ejection port up, pointed downrange, exactly as I should do. As I do, I realize the shooting has stopped. It's silent in the range, which is shocking and weird, and I quickly strip off the earmuffs. I'm alone. There's not a single person left in the bays. There's just Javier at the end by the door, watching me. Because of where he's standing, I can't see his face that clearly. He's right under one of the spots, which glares bright on the top of his head, shimmering on close-cropped brown hair, and casts his expression into shadow. "Guess I'm not that great for business," I say.
"No, you're fantastic for business," he replies. "Sold so much ammo in the past few days, I had to restock twice. Too bad I don't own a gun store. I could retire just on this week. Paranoia sells."
He sounds normal, but something about this feels strange. I load everything into my gun case and lock it, and I'm shoving it back into the backpack when Javier takes a step forward. His eyes are dead. It's unsettling. He's not armed, but that doesn't make him any less alarming.
"Got a question for you," he says. "It's pretty basic. Did you know?"
"Know what?" I say, though there's really only one question he could be asking.
"What your husband was doing."
"No." I tell him the absolute truth, but I have zero hope that he'll believe me. Mel didn't need or want my help. I'm a woman. Women are never people to someone like him. I zip up the backpack. "If you're going to do some vigilante justice here, get on with it. I'm not armed now. I couldn't take you even if I was, and we both know it." He doesn't move, doesn't speak. He's just regarding me, assessing me. And I remember that, like Mel, Javier knows what it means to take a life. Unlike Mel, The reason for his anger right now doesn't come from selfishness and narcissism. Javier sees himself as a protector, as a man who fights for right. It doesn't mean I'm in any less danger. When he does finally speak, it comes out soft, almost a whisper.
How come you didn't tell me?
About Mel? Why do you think? I left all that behind me. I wanted to. Wouldn't you?
I let out a sigh.
Come on, Javi. Please. I need to get back to my kids.
They're all right. Casey's watching them.
There's something about the way he says her name that clears things up for me. Kezia Claremont didn't come just because of her father's concern. Her father had met me exactly once, and while he seemed a nice old guy, that hadn't quite rung true for me. She'd mentioned Javier in a businesslike way, but the way Javier refers to her is more revealing. I can see the connection immediately. Javier likes strong ladies, and Kez is definitely that.
Thing is, I almost helped you get out of town right after that first murder.
Doesn't sit right with me, Gwen. Not at all. You sat in my kitchen and drank my beer, and I think, what if you did know? What if you sat in your own kitchen back in Kansas and listened to those women scream in the garage while your husband did his thing? You think I wouldn't care about that?
I know you would, I tell him, and slip the backpack over my shoulder.
They never screamed, Javier.
They couldn't. The first thing Mel did was cut their vocal cords when he abducted them. He had a special knife for it. The police showed it to me. I never heard them screaming because they couldn't scream. So yes, I fixed lunch in my kitchen. I made meals for my children. I ate breakfast and lunch and dinner. And there were women dying on the other side of that fucking wall. And don't you think I hate that I didn't stop it?
I lost control at the end of that, and the echoes of my shout come back like bullets, striking me hard. I close my eyes and breathe, smelling burned powder and gun oil and my own sudden sweat. My mouth tastes sour, all the breakfast sweetness curdled. I see her in a flash again, that skinless girl dangling, and I have to bend over and put my hands on my knees. The gun case slides forward and knocks me in the back of the head. But I don't care. I just need to breathe. When Javier touches me, I flinch. But he just helps me stand up and braces me until I nod and pull away. I'm ashamed of myself, of my weakness. I want to scream. Again. Instead, I say, I used all the ammo I brought. Can I buy a couple of boxes? He silently leaves and comes back to set two boxes on the ledge of Bay 8, turns to go. I slide the backpack off and sit it at my feet, braced against the wall of the bay, and say, "Thank you." He doesn't answer. He just leaves. I go through most of the two boxes, shredding target after target, center mass, head, targeting extremities for variety, until my ears are ringing even with the hearing protection, and the noise inside me is finally still. Then I pack up and leave. Javier is not in the store. I pay for the ammunition. Sophie conducts the transaction in mutinous silence, thrusting me my charge across the counter rather than handing it to me. God forbid she might actually touch the ex-wife of a killer. That shit might be contagious. I exit, still looking for Javier, but his truck is gone, and the parking lot is pretty much deserted, except for Sophie's conventional blue Ford, parked in the shady spot. I reverse my run to head home, but as I pass Sam Cade's house, I see that he's sitting on the front porch, drinking a cup of coffee, and against my conscious decision, I slow down to look at him. He looks back, sets the coffee down, and stands up.
"Hey,"
he says. "It's not much, but it's more than I got at the range." He looks uncomfortable, a little flushed, but also determined.
"So, we should probably talk."
I stare at him for a second. I think about kicking up my run and taking off, fast and hard, retreating. But two things that Kezia said keep echoing in my head. First, Sam Cade has alibis for the girls' abductions. Second, I need allies. I look down at the house. Kez's car is still there.
"Sure,"
I tell him, walking over to mount the steps of the porch.
He gets a little more tense, and so do I, and for a second there's silence as deep as back in the shooting range.
So?
Talk. He looks down at his coffee cup, and from where I stand I can see it's empty. He shrugs, throws open the front door of the cabin, and walks inside. I pause on the doorstep for 1 second, two, and then follow. It's dark inside, and I have to blink a couple of times as he turns on some dim overheads and skims back one of the checkered curtains covering the windows. He goes straight to a coffee pot, fills his cup, takes down another, and splashes it full. He hands it to me, along with the sugar, without a word. It should feel comfortable, but it feels like effort, like a steel bar between us that we're struggling to get around. I sip the coffee and remember that he likes hazelnut blend. So do I.
Thanks, I say.
You smell like gunpowder, he tells me. Been up shooting at the range?
Until they tell me I can't, I will, I say.
Cops let you go, then?
Seems like.
He studies me over the top of the cup, cautious, dark eyes guarded.
You too.
Because I'm not fucking guilty, Sam.
Yeah, he drinks. So you said, Gwen.
I nearly throw the coffee in his face for that, but I manage not to, mainly because I know it would only get me arrested for assault, and besides, it's not hot enough to scald. Then I wonder why I'm so damn angry. He has the right to hate me. I don't have the right to hate him back. I can resent his deception, sure, but in the end, there's only one of us with a real grudge, real pain. I sink down in a chair, suddenly very tired, and am only aware of drinking the coffee in a peripheral sense kind of way. I'm consumed with watching him, with wondering suddenly who he really is, who I really am. How can we possibly rebuild any kind of ease between us?
Why did you come here? I ask him.
The truth, this time. Sam doesn't vary his focus at all.
I wasn't lying. I'm writing a book. It's about my sister's murder. Yeah, I tracked you down. It took a friend in military intelligence to do it, and, by the way, he was very impressed with how you kept disappearing. I missed you 4 times in a row. I took a chance you'd stay here since you bought the place this time.
So, the stalking isn't in my imagination, not at all.
That's how,
not why. I wanted you to confess what you did, he says.
He blinks, as if he's surprised he said it out loud.
It was all I thought about. I'd built you up into... Look, I believed you were part of it, knew everything. I thought you...
were guilty, I finish for him. You're hardly alone. You're not even in the minority.
I swallow some coffee without tasting it.
I don't blame you for that. I don't. In your position, I'd have
done anything to get justice.
I'd have killed me.
Yeah. He draws that out into a sigh. Problem is, once I met you, talked to you, got to know you, I couldn't see it. I saw somebody who barely survived what she'd gone through and just wanted to keep her family safe. You just weren't... her.
Gina wasn't guilty either, I tell him.
She was just naive, and she wanted to be happy. He knew how to take advantage of that.
Silence falls. I find myself breaking it by saying, I saw your sister. She was the last one. I saw her the day the car crashed into the garage. Sam freezes, holds for just a bare second, then smoothly puts down his coffee. The mug hits the table surface a little hard. There's a matte, polished expanse of wood between us, not an invisible barrier, and maybe that's better. I could reach across it.
So could he.
Neither of us does.
I saw the photos, he says,
and I remember how he told me never to let my kids see pictures. Now I know why. It wasn't a vague sympathy after all, and it hadn't been about what he'd seen in Afghanistan.
I don't suppose you can forget it either.
No. I swallow coffee, but my mouth feels dry anyway. I've taken the seat nearest the open window, and the buttery light illuminates him in ways that are both kind and unkind. It reveals the fine lines around his eyes, bracketing his mouth,
a peculiar little indentation near his left eyebrow, a pale, almost invisible spiderweb of scarring that runs from under his hairline into his right cheek. It sparks color flecks in his eyes that make them mesmerizing. I see her all the time, in flashes. Whenever I close my eyes, she's there. Her name was Callie, he tells me,